The Lebanon example will then carry over into the 90s. As you start to see U.S. interventions in places like Somalia, Haiti, you'll start to hear, is this another Lebanon?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Security Dilemma, a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. I'm Patrick Carver Fox, joined by John Allen Gaze, as we have a conversation with Dr. Osama Khalil, the author of A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad, from Kennedy to Biden. It's a great book, and we're announcing a JQAS reading group on it. Go to our website in the description of this episode and sign up. We'll send you a copy. If you're in the DC area, sign up for our in-person reading group and come have dinner with me and chat about the book. If you can't make it, you can still discuss the book in a group over Zoom in our remote session. One more note, JQAS is holding our summer conference in mid-July. If you're a student, including master's or PhD, or a young professional with less than 2 years of experience in foreign policy, we encourage you to apply. If selected, we'll fly you to Washington, D.C., and you can hear from keynote speakers, scholars, and grand strategy, and more awesome programming. But back to today's show. Dr. Khalil is a history professor at Syracuse University and a historian of U.S. foreign relations in the modern Middle East. He published America's Dream Palace, Middle East Expertise and the Rise of the National Security State, which examined how American policymakers studied the Middle East between World War I and the Iraq War. It was named the best book of 2017 by Foreign Affairs magazine, and he released A World of Enemies, his second book, on April 16th, and we're excited to speak with him about it today. Let's jump into our conversation with Dr. Osama Khalil. Dr. Khalil, welcome to Security Dilemma.
Happy to be here.
The title of your book describes wars both at home and abroad. What would you say is the central argument of this book?
So the central argument is that we tend to think of the domestic sphere and the foreign policy sphere as separate and distinct. And what I demonstrate in the book is that they're not at all, right? So that domestic policy and domestic politics have influenced foreign policy. And in a number of different ways, the United States has exported aspects of its domestic policies related to crime, drugs, and the war on terror overseas, but they've also been fought here in the streets of America, and both at an individual level and at a broader societal level. And so the book also traces out the implications of that over six plus decades and a number of administrations. And it shows how we've come to not just a militarized foreign policy, but in effect, a militarized domestic policy as well.
So why did you start with John F. Kennedy? I was talking with John earlier about how the premise of this book reminds me a bit of the story of Smedley Butler and his job being the public safety director of Philadelphia. Right. But you start with Kennedy. What really changes with Kennedy?
Well, so part of it has to do with the Vietnam War, right? And so where you begin that story is, you know, can be a bit contentious. Do you begin with Truman? Do you begin with Eisenhower? But what we really see with Kennedy is both the adoption of counterinsurgency techniques. The United States is going to throw everything it has at Vietnam and still fail. And I think what's interesting about the Kennedy presidency is, and this is where you can see this consistency with Eisenhower, particularly on Vietnam, is, you know, he disagrees with almost everything Ike does, except for Cuba and South Vietnam. So much of what happens here, you know, in Vietnam policy, it's him adopting Ike's policy, but then also introducing a number of other levels to it that, you know, have a broad influence, not just on Johnson, but of course Nixon. And then one of the other key aspects about Vietnam and Kennedy is the attempt to contain Vietnam, right? To contain this losing war and how early they knew it was a losing war. And yet the United States will continue to adopt and throw different types of measures in a vain hope of either somehow getting a victory or delaying defeat. And often it's about delaying defeat. And that's one of the other key things. So, you know, Kennedy it's interesting in a number of ways. It's only a 1,000-day presidency, but the implications of it, particularly for South Vietnam, are really profound. I mean, let's not forget, less than a month before Kennedy's assassinated, right, we had the Diem coup and assassination in South Vietnam. That is sold as leading to a quicker end to the war in South Vietnam. That's the way Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., that's the way a number of different advisors are going to say to the Kennedy White House and then later to LBJ, we think this is going to help us win the war. And very quickly after LBJ becomes president, they find out that's not the case at all, that we have, it's, you know, it's, the situation is much worse than it was just even a few months ago. And then that leads to, and of course, and one of the points I make in the book is that, you know, there's still a lot of debate about what Kennedy would have done had he lived. what would he have done if he had gotten the same assessment that LBJ gets by January of 64, which is the situation is much, much worse, right? Particularly after the decision to overthrow the Diem government. So we don't know exactly what Kennedy would have done. He probably wouldn't have done what LBJ did. And I think a number of different historians and Robert McNamara writes that as well, Kennedy and LBJ, Secretary of Defense. But what is important is that because by the time LBJ becomes president and the situation on the ground, in a way, I don't want to say it limits LBJ's options, because he himself limits his own options, how he wants to do it. But there is an unfolding fire inside South Vietnam that's going to be very difficult for the United States to put out. And then, of course, all the domestic politics components come in.
One of my favorite parts of this book is how you highlight the careers of some relatively unknown, national security officials. And one of the characters early in your book is Blowtorch Bob Comer. The role that he played in shaping both Vietnam policy, but also some elements of late Johnson administration criminal justice policy. What should listeners know about Bob Comer and his role in the sort of mid to late 1960s?
So Comer is a true believer, right? So he is one of the architects of the Vietnam War. He's an architect of the U.S.'s counterinsurgency policy. Comer is one of these individuals who will either be on record or as one of these senior administration officials that's quoted anonymously that we always see, who is constantly talking about that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that we are winning this war. And he will say that up until the Tet Offensive, and he'll say it after the Tet Offensive. He is the guy who will find the silver lining in every single problem the United States is facing in Vietnam. And even, we'll have this issue, as I talk about in the book, where Kennedy's also, to tie the two back to your earlier question, so he's also going to be consistent from Kennedy into Johnson. Kennedy's going to inspire a number of very young individuals to join Foreign Service, right? So people that I talk about, not just Comer, but for example, Richard Holbrooke, Anthony Lake, all of these key figures who will now over the next several decades will be in and out of government service. And Comer's one of these individuals, right, who will have several different roles within the Kennedy and then Johnson administrations before he's put in charge of pacification. He has this nickname of Blowtorch Bob, and you'll hear various different explanations for why that is. Is it because he had a hot temper? Is it because he was really sharp in a meeting? Is it because that was his favorite torture technique? Unclear, right? And may have been all of them, not to be too facetious here. What's interesting about him also is his idea, and at an institutional level, of these connections, and he will influence others, including Walt Whitman Rostow. Stuart Schrader has a great book about the role of policing and the connection between policing and counterinsurgency, and his book also helped influence my book, and really fascinating story. And that's also where you'll see Comer, is this emphasis on police and policing, international policing, right, based on the U.S. approach, that will go out and will see the police as a counterinsurgency tool. And that's exactly how it's going to be portrayed. And that's exactly how Comer sees it. And then we'll see that back domestically. One of the things, where Johnson becomes so important and Walt Whitman Rostow is we'll see this transition from Kennedy to Johnson and this idea of particularly the rise of a notion of law and order as the anti-war protests kick in. As you start to get domestic upheaval, the Detroit riots, the Newark riots, or the Newark and Detroit rebellions, as they're called, that what we'll see is this initial discussion of law and order, first proposed by Waltman Rostow with Johnson, and then that will be adopted by Nixon wholeheartedly. And so, I try and trace that out a little bit as well. And within that is the role of increasingly militarized policing that will begin under Johnson. And one of the other pieces I trace out in the book is how, by the time we get to the Obama administration, the vast quantities of weapons that are being recycled into state and local police forces, it's an enormous sums of money that start off fairly small under Johnson and then into the billions by the time we get to Obama.
So how is the legacy of the Vietnam War playing out in terms of this domestic environment? Because you talk about how some of these people involved thought that it would lead the U.S. to do a lot less abroad and to not get tangled up in some of these conflicts. But you say it's more complicated.
Well, it's definitely more complicated. So one of the issues is that, and as I talk about, there's a number, and as Patrick mentioned, there's a number of these key members of the foreign policy, intelligence community, the military, who come out of the Vietnam generation, and they all try and draw different lessons from Vietnam. They're not all the same lesson. They don't all view it the same way, but they will refer back to it for better and often for worse, as I talk about in the book. One of the lessons out of Vietnam is the following, that, you know, one, we didn't use enough military force, right? The military had its hand tied behind its back. It's one of these narratives you'll often hear. The press lost us the war. The public lost us the war. It was the campus protesters. So one of the ways U.S. doesn't stay out of these different conflicts is because you have some of these military officials, sometimes foreign service officials, who either won't, you know, misapply the lessons of Vietnam as they see them, okay? Oftentimes they will take certain things like Vietnamization and or the Phoenix program. We could talk about both of those if you want. So the Phoenix program was this assassination program. Vietnamization was the program to rely increasingly on the South Vietnamese army so that there'd be fewer American troops fighting and fewer casualties, obviously. Both of those will be adopted in different ways over the next 5 to 6 decades, but they will also be suggested they were successes when in fact they were not successes. But that's how they'll be presented to the American public often. I think the other big thing, and this takes us back to Patrick's question about Kennedy. You know, Kennedy comes into office, soaring rhetoric. You all know the great lines from his inauguration speech. And yet, you know, within a decade, you see the United States mired in Vietnam, domestic strife. And you can draw this line from the Kennedy assassination to the Nixon resignation as kind of that era of the tumultuous 60s. But one of the things that also comes out is, in spite of that soaring rhetoric, where we are by the 1970s is this belief that America is in decline. So the post-Vietnam, post-Watergate American decline, and staving off, or the perception of needing to stave off that decline, will also be a consistent thread that runs through the next 5 to 6 decades. And so you'll see successive presidents, their advisors, but also columnists, different academic experts talking about America in decline and what this means and how to stave off decline. And often this will be tied to military adventures abroad and military policy abroad.
You mentioned the Phoenix program and how it had this network of assassinations. How did that bleed into American domestic policy? Like you mentioned COINTELPRO. Yeah. And Operation Minaret, the CIA program. Yeah. How did the Phoenix program essentially hit American shores?
Well, so it happens in a couple of different ways, right? So I think when we look at, it's this idea that we are fighting radicals abroad and radicals at home, right? So when you see, for example, you know, the fact that the FBI is monitoring Black radicals, and is particularly the Black Panther movement, is deliberately targeting the Black Panthers at home, and the way they are categorized is also kind of this, it's directly connected in so many ways to the Phoenix program. The fact that you have this overlap between the individuals who chased down Che Guevara in Bolivia and then go to Southeast Asia to lead the Phoenix program. So you'll see these interlinkages across different combat zones and different policies and programs. One of the key aspects about the Phoenix program is how much of it is based on, just quite frankly, you know, made up numbers. So this idea that for your listeners who may not know this, the idea is this behind the program is that the CIA is going to make a claim that the what they call the Viet Cong insurgency, the VCI, consists of some 50 some thousand individuals, right? So where do they come up with this number? And it's an amazingly specific and yet, you know, questionable number. And the argument is that this is the number of individuals from South Vietnam who go north, right? Get trained and then infiltrate back into the South to form the Viet Cong, right? And what the US calls the Viet Cong or the National Liberation Front. And so the idea is, well, if we can, you know, if just look at this 54,000 number, and they'll come up with these goals and targets to eliminate that 54,000 number over the next few years, then we've destroyed the Viet Cong infrastructure. It's a remarkable claim. I mean, on the face of it, it's amazing that this actually appealed to people. One of the things we now know, and from the Pentagon Papers, is how often, you know, these different proposals are made and are viewed with skepticism internally, but then publicly are presented as verifiable fact. This is absolutely the case. This is going to work, and it absolutely is going to work. And one of the things I talk about in the book, within the first year of the Phoenix program, they're already acknowledging, well, you know, yeah, we've killed a certain number of Vietnamese, but those numbers have probably been replenished by now. Well, you know, but the whole rationale here was that you were going to wipe out the Viet Cong infrastructure. Now you're saying that the rate of replenishment is greater than what you've been able to eliminate. Then there's the other problem, which is who were they actually assassinating? Was it they weren't actually killing the leadership of the NLF? They weren't even killing at the higher levels. These were civilians, and they were being tagged. You know, they're being tagged as insurgents, right? And so it's another consistent thread you'll see throughout. It's a way we think about them. When we talk about, for example, when I bring in the war on drugs, when you think about body counts in Vietnam or body counts later in Iraq, right? The number of insurgents killed. And then it turns out, you know, that these were largely civilians. You have the same kind of rationale that plays into the supply side approach to the war on drugs. How much drugs were intercepted? How much is it worth? And of course, these numbers are all inflated. The amount that we're intercepting is inflated. And this, of course, itself leads into the institutionalization of these conflicts. And so that's one of the ways that the Phoenix program, there's at the base level of assassination overseas and assassination at home, and particularly of political figures and quote unquote radicals. But then also just that notion, the numerical notion that somehody you can put a number on this. And once we eliminate that number, we can achieve, we've achieved victory. And in fact, we see that that's just not the case at all.
We'd like to make our way from the 1970s into the 1980s. And one piece of connective tissue for this book is the history of American policy toward the Palestinian diaspora. The way that America handled, Jordan in the 60s and 70s. I'm more than most books on similar subjects, World of Enemies really tracks these Arab-Israeli conflicts as key to the development of American foreign policy. Specifically in the 60s and 70s, what lessons do you think we can take away about the relationship between America's wars abroad in this region and how it affected our views of domestic policy?
That's a great question, and it works at several levels. And I think one of the things I point out very quickly is, so, you know, the Nixon doctrine. You know, Nixon is going to introduce this as a way of reducing not just America's commitments in Vietnam, but America's global commitments. And we're going to rely on local allies instead of U.S. troops. And one of the first places it's tested is in Jordan, the Jordanian Civil War. I mean, almost immediately it's tested. And so one of the issues when we come to the Arab-Israeli conflict, particularly the Palestinian issue, is how often the United States, it intersects not just with other conflicts globally, right? But that there was a potential for resolution very early that the United States under Johnson, then Nixon, and of course through onto Ford and Carter, that the United States will avoid. In many cases, what the U.S. will do is will not view the Palestinians as a political problem, but as a humanitarian problem. And it allows it to avoid this really thorny issue of negotiations. And we'll get to this point in the 70s with Kissinger, where he will effectively recognize that, you know, we can't ignore the Palestine Liberation Organization. We just don't want to deal with them, right? What we're going to try and do is we're going to deal with them after resolving every other issue, particularly at the state level, then we'll deal with the non-state actor. And instead, what ends up happening is the PLO ends up becoming, and the Palestinians become, this constant thorn and wrinkle in the negotiation because they're at the heart of it. So it's part of this is about the U.S. unwilling to recognize what's at the heart of this conflict, because it starts to get really thorny and really difficult. Kissinger has this great quote where he says something like, you know, we can't meet the minimal demands of the PLO, so why talk to them? And where this is coming from is he's under a lot of pressure, actually. You know, it's one of the things where Egypt, where he's trying to bring Egypt over to the U.S. side, where he's trying to negotiate initially disengagement agreements between Egypt and Israel. And Egypt, the Algerians, the Saudis are telling the U.S., look, you have to talk to the PLO. Okay, at some point, you have to deal with this issue. And so Kissinger's trying to hold it off as long as possible. And there are different points in the book that I point to where, you know, there's also this kind of this vain hope the U.S. has that, well, maybe the problem will just go away in a way, you know, if the Lebanese Civil War will help take care of this. The Syrians who intervene in the Lebanese Civil War will help take care of the Palestinian problem. The Israelis, by the time you get to 1982 in the Reagan administration, one of the things the Israelis promise is we're gonna eliminate the PLO. We can get rid of this and we'll take care of this problem immediately, right? And so what you end up getting, and this is another thread of the book, is that the U.S. will often rely on an overt use of force to avoid a thorny diplomatic solution, right? Or a thorny diplomatic negotiation. And it's a real problem. It consists, and we're still dealing with it, quite frankly, today. I mean, this is the issue you're seeing on the ground today that we've been dealing with. you know, there's an emphasis, and we can come back to it later. You know, the book ends obviously before October 7th, but you can see this in this discussion where you want to look at the October 7th attacks by Hamas and this tendency to view this as kind of history beginning on October 7th. And this book points out that, no, this is a much longer history and a much longer history of American involvement. But one of the other reasons why the Arab-Israeli conflict is central here, and not central, but it has such an important role in the book, is because it is fought overseas and then here. Even though you will see this connection to Vietnam in several different ways, you'll see the PLO attempting to adopt the strategy of the Vietnamese, what they call fighting and talking. It's the same thing the Algerians did. You'll see high-profile terrorist attacks, much like Algeria did, in an attempt to kind of get, you know, to galvanize international attention, international media attention. And so even though in the United States we'll hear, you know, in the press, and you often hear about Viet Cong terror, it's going to be Palestinian acts of terrorism that will help kind of drive this home in the United States into what is this whole idea of defining what is terrorism, who defines what terrorism is, what differentiates terrorism from political violence, what differentiates a guerrilla from a terrorist. And then, of course, there'll be a domestic component. So you mentioned COINTELPRO in your previous question. So COINTELPRO was targeted at Black radicals, the anti-war movement, the New Left. What we'll instead get after the 1972 attack at the Olympic Games by the Black September Organization is something called Operation Boulder. So it'll be a way of kind of taking COINTELPRO and focusing it on Arab and Arab American students, graduate students, and anyone with kind of an immigrant visa from key countries. And what we now know is that effectively, you know, what Operation Boulder was really targeted at was key Palestinian groups, those that the U.S. had labeled, you know, and at that point, even if they weren't labeled terrorist organizations as we think of them today, that they believed them to be radical organizations that they were going to monitor heavily. And so that's another way where this gets fought at home. And then Operation Boulder, we'll see elements of it returning again by the global war on terror. So, you know, there are these threads that run through that reemerge. So from COINTELPRO to Operation Boulder. Now, what's also interesting about Operation Boulder, I note this in the book, and because you mentioned this, so there are some secret campaigns. So Minaret, what becomes, you know, is Operation Minaret and Operation Chaos. And for your the listeners who don't know them, these were the NSA spying initiatives. So what Operation Minaret, the way that starts and then gets taken over by LBJ and then Nixon, is it's initially targeting Fidel Castro in Cuba and Cuban agents here in the U.S., but also other communist agents. But then it starts to get a little vague, right? Because it's like, well, we're also targeting Black radicals, and we're targeting, that would include, you know, MLK, right? Malcolm X is being spied on, both by the FBI, but then broader surveillance. There'll be also some other groups, and then that's the program, that monitoring program that gets picked up by LBJ, where he's going to ask the CIA now to expand and start looking at the anti-war movement. So it's going to move from kind of this watch list that they had of suspected communists, radicals, et cetera, to now focusing on the anti-war movement to demonstrate that there was some kind of Soviet conspiracy. All this is completely covert. What's interesting about Operation Boulder is that the U.S. is very open about it, right? So it's covered in the New York Times. This is happening. You have Arab American groups, including, the Arab Information Center, which is tied to the UN mission, also saying, look, you know, we're being tracked on the way home. We think, you know, our offices are being ransacked. This is being done out in the open versus Operation Chaos, which, you know, again, was covert, was led by the CIA under James Angleton, and then is taken up by Nixon to basically spy on all of his enemies, including members of his cabinet, members of his NSC. The list just goes on and on by the time you get from what began as a small list. And in fact, one of the things I talk about is in their own internal history, the NSA will say something to the effect of, we recognize that this was now bordering on illegality at some point and that we needed to unwind it. So they recognize that they're really testing the limits of their authority. And we can see that by the 70s. Of course, all of that gets abandoned. And I talk about that later in the book, by other much larger warrantless wiretapping initiatives that are adopted as part of the war on drugs and then again the war on terror.
Speaking of the selective and politicized use of terms like terrorism, you emphasize the duality between Che Guevara's call for many Vietnams and CIA Director William Casey's call for half a dozen Afghanistans. What do each of them mean by that?
You know, what Che is, and you know, he's an interesting figure, right? Because one of the things he is hoping to do is kind of recreate the success. And so we talk about, you know, the Vietnam example for the U.S., right, where, you know, misapplying certain lessons. And Che, in a sense, is going to do that in the Congo. He's going to do it in Bolivia. And this idea that the example of the Cuban Revolution or what's happening in Vietnam can be applied more broadly. And in fact, he won't have a lot of success doing that. But for him, and it's in this famous speech where he calls for many Vietnams as a way to challenge, as he sees it, American imperialism abroad, right? What's interesting is, and Kyle Burke does a great job of tracing this out, is it also leads to, through the 70s and into the 80s, this conservative counter-revolution. Back here in the U.S., they're going to see a couple of different triggers for this. They see the anti-war movement not as a positive, and the rise of the new left, the positive, they see this as just absolutely anathema. And it's tied to, of course, the civil rights movement, which they also see as just the worst possible thing that could happen. They will see that as connected to this broader Soviet-led conspiracy that threatens, America's America at home and America standing abroad. So by the time you get to Bill Casey and Reagan in the 80s, that is already... That conservative counter-revolution is already underway. And so even though you've had this pressure to kind of reduce American involvement at the governmental level, and there's some tensions about this that I trace out in the book, particularly what Kissinger will try and do through the Safari Club, for example, mm-hmm. which will attempt to, you know, connect different intelligence agencies and work to counter Soviet influence in Africa as well as South Asia, when the United States can't directly be involved because of congressional limitations. At the same time, by the time you get to Casey and Reagan in the 80s, that conservative counter-revolution is well underway. So when he's calling for many Afghanistans, the idea is to counter Soviet influence wherever they can find it. And they will say, and you'll see this as I talk about in some of the memos, we may not win all of them, and we may not win any of them, but the key is to kind of to fight the Soviet Union on as many fronts as possible and to exhaust them. And to try and count our wins where we can. And so part of what I'm trying to show there is also what this ends up doing is entrenching many different conflicts in a way that either because of real or perceived Soviet influence that in a sense the U.S. feels it has to counter. And then by the end of the Cold War, some of these are just left to fester, these different conflicts. And in fact, they're not resolved. And we see that in a number of different ways.
So you mentioned earlier how the war on drugs, you know, which part of that framing emerges from Vietnam, then informs the war on terror and things like some of the widespread warrantless wiretapping, you know, which is a hot subject in Washington right now because some of these authorities are coming back.
Yeah. Oh, no. This is what's so, I think, interesting is, and I look at it a couple of ways. So one of the threads of the book is this connection between the wars on crime, drugs, and terror. And what's interesting about this connection between the war on crime and drugs is the following. So there's one way you can look at it, which is, of course, militarized policing and mass incarceration. And this becomes very clear under Nixon, right? So Nixon's decision for the war on drugs is very deliberate. And it's deliberate at two different levels. One is, how do we target the quote-unquote enemies of the conservative movement, which is minorities as he sees them, and of course the anti-war left and the new left, the anti-war movement rather. And this, of course, he's going to run against this. Ronald Reagan will also be, you know, this is one of the places where they're going to come together at the Republican National Convention in 68 and just really have some real raw meat to go after with this combination. The problem is when Nixon's team looks at this issue of crime, what they find is, well, you know, where the biggest bang for the buck is at the local level with crime, right? Local, maybe state, but the president can't get credit for that. But if we focus on drugs, because this is actually a federal issue, especially because you have interstate or interstate commerce component, that's something where the president can, and there's a foreign policy aspect to it. So one of the things Nixon is absolutely going to embrace is not just the rhetoric of the war on drugs at home, but he's going to empower, for example, Patrick Moynihan, who later becomes senator, but it's one of his key advisors, who's going to go out and they're going to target two countries, Turkey and Mexico. So there's going to be a huge foreign policy component. Mm-hmm. And some of this ties into, you know, something Nixon's going to say in the campaign trail about we're going to go at the heart of this problem, right? So that's going to be adopted. You know, you're going to have Nixon who's going to take it on when we think about this kind of initiation, this idea of a war on drugs, even though, you know, Kennedy and Johnson will do some things and we could trace it back further. And other scholars have, like Jeremy Kosmarev has. But where Reagan's going to come in by the time we get to the 80s is now put this on steroids. And so one of the things Reagan is going to do is both really rely on America's Cold War arsenal. And we're going to focus it inward and we're going to begin to focus it outward, right? So we're going to move away, not just from kind of what Nixon's going to try and do is use foreign policy and foreign assistance to pressure Mexico and pressure Turkey, or think they can pressure Mexico and Turkey. It won't, of course, succeed. And it's going to have other implications as well, as I talk about in the book. But for Reagan, now we start to see this kind of escalating notion of extending America's borders out into the Caribbean and into the Pacific for interdiction efforts, the real enhanced emphasis on supply. What we're also going to start to see is not just, you know, we have two major drug laws that are passed under Reagan, 86 and 88. And then, of course, international treaties where the U.S. is also going to extend. And this is one of the pieces of the book that I think is important, is how the U.S. attempts to use its role in the international order, you know, the key power in the international order on international treaties to apply its own view of the war on drugs and how to combat drugs into international treaties. And so we'll see that, of course, by the end of the Reagan administration be carried through by Bush and onward. You know, where we see, for example, you know, we have by the time we get into the 90s, is the DEA is going to initiate, the Drug Enforcement Administration is going to initiate a massive warrantless wiretapping initiative that goes on for over a decade. And it encompasses 100 plus countries. And the way they justify this is like, basically they will say, well, these are all areas where, you know, drug trafficking is involved. So it's this massive effort. And yet you would be hard pressed. And the DEA, of course, hasn't had to justify this in any way. You would be hard pressed to say that it had any impact on drug trafficking at all, you know, in into the United States or globally. But what's really interesting is that program will then also serve as a template for the NSA after 9/11 and when warrantless wiretapping is fully approved by the Bush administration as part of kind of the global war on terror. So you see these threads that take us through from, we could start with Operation Minaret in the 50s on the wiretapping all the way to 9/11 and beyond to where we are today with these debates about basically undermining, you don't even need a FISA warrant anymore. And I talk about in the book how basically, you know, by the time we get to 2019, 2020, the number of FISA warrants for even just terrorism-related cases are really minor, and almost all of it's drug-related. So it's really interesting how these, you know, what started as a template from the war on drugs to be applied to the war on terror has now reverted from the war on terror back to the war on drugs. And one of the things I'm trying to argue in the book, and I'm not the first one to do it, there's many others, you know, which is we need to radically rethink our domestic policy when it comes to drugs and, of course, surveillance. And what actual benefit it's having, and who it's actually serving, because it's clearly not having an impact at any level on the drug trade. And until we actually deal with this as adults, quite frankly, and start to look at this and understand how addiction works, the institutionalization of the drug war just continues on.
Your book emphasizes the Reagan administration's participation in the Lebanon War in 1982. How does America's experience in Lebanon in the 1980s ultimately inform future U.S. policy in the Middle East in the 1990s and 2000s? Yeah,
that's a great question. So, you know, Reagan inherits, and here's what's really fascinating about Reagan. So Reagan inherits the Camp David Accord between Israel and Egypt. And the idea is, you know, Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian president, will be severely criticized by other Arab states because he broke the unified Arab negotiating position. Now, Sadat had hoped that other Arab states would follow through. That didn't happen. And one of the reasons it doesn't happen is that we see that the Reagan administration essentially adopts this idea that, you know, we've broken the kind of the unified Arab negotiating position. We're now able to just negotiate bilateral agreements and we can ignore the Palestinians. And of course, this is going to come to a head in the 80s, in 1982 in Lebanon, when the Reagan administration greenlights Israel's invasion of Lebanon to eliminate the PLO. So what ends up happening is that the PLO is severely defeated militarily. Politically, it still survives. But what ends up happening for Israel and for the United States is that it leads to the emergence of Hezbollah, which itself now is a far more powerful organization than the PLO was in the 1980s, in which it itself has, you know, committed itself to the full liberation of Lebanese territory from Israeli occupation, and has served, has become now this kind of not only a resistance movement, but also an element of the Lebanese government, right? And of course, it represents the majority of the Lebanese population. The majority of the Lebanese population are Shia. And so it's a Shia political party. And so that's one of the ways, of course, where we start to see the implications of the decision to go to war in Lebanon, for the U.S. to support Israel and Lebanon. The other way it happens is that the U.S. doesn't stay on the sidelines, right? So Israel is going to fight for some 70 days. It's going to surround and besiege West Beirut. Part of the negotiation to get the PLO leadership to leave Beirut is that the U.S. agrees to safeguard Palestinian civilians. So they will send in a multinational force that consists of the British, the French, and the Italians. They will stay for a brief period of time, and then they will leave. And right after they leave, there's a massacre of Palestinian refugees in which these, you know, the Israelis have basically surrounded major Palestinian refugee camps, and they allow the Lebanese Christian Phalange militia in as part of a quote-unquote, they're supposed to go in there and quote-unquote disarm what's left of the PLO fighters that are there. And really what it is, it's a revenge attack for the assassination of the new Lebanese president who's a member of the Phalange Party. Now, the PLO will be blamed, but it's pretty clear it's the Syrians. The U.S. will come back into Lebanon. The multinational force will come back in. And then very quickly will become this active participant in the existing Lebanese civil war. So it's going to become just yet another militia in this fight. And of course, what we'll see is now the emergence of, as I talked about, Hezbollah, and Hezbollah will begin targeting Americans, including a car bomb attack on the U.S. embassy, an attack on U.S. Marines, the U.S. Marine base. And eventually, the Reagan administration is going to decide to cut its losses and leave. Now, Reagan will be criticized for this over time, right? That what you should have done, because this is going to be a rift within the administration, and then even those outside of the administration who are going to argue that this emboldened terrorism. But what we also know is that Reagan's going to embark on his own mini war on terror that we're still trying to learn the outlines of, right? So some of this, I talk a little bit of this in from what I could gather from different sources in the book. There's still a lot out there that we don't know, but we can get elements of. But that includes targeting other quote-unquote terrorist organizations, including going after Hezbollah, it appears. But also, as part of, back to your question about the many Afghanistans, you know, this war on terror is going to be kind of very broad. It's going to be selective, and it's going to include states like Libya. It includes targeting Iran. It'll include the different militias in Lebanon, and of course, a different cast of characters that it may include, you know, sabotage attacks, including Soviet targets or Soviet proxies, right? So it's a really interesting, you know, moment in the 1980s of this kind of the covert proxy war that's going on against the Soviet Union that the Reagan administration adopts, but also this mini war on terror that we're still learning more about. You know, one of the other components there is, again, that criticism, the Lebanon example, will then carry over into the 90s. And so you'll see this in the post-Cold War era, where as you start to see U.S. interventions in places like Somalia, Haiti, you'll start to hear questions about kind of like, is this another Lebanon? You know, like Somalia, that will happen with Somalia in the 90s, that, you know, especially after U.S. troops are attacked and the now infamous Black Hawk Down incident. On the Senate floor, you'll hear discussions about, again, referring back to Lebanon. You know, is this another Lebanon example? Senator John McCain, Senator Robert Byrd will bring that up. It's another reason for us not to get involved. So Reagan's decisions in Lebanon are going to have some implications immediately and then carried forward as kind of reference points of when the U.S. should not get involved in a fight. Although others will say, you made a mistake by pulling out. And this will be one of the lessons, for example, that neoconservatives will draw on by the time of the war on terror, that this was a mistake, that what Reagan did was actually emboldened groups like Hezbollah, because they believe that they could take the United States on. That'll come back in 2006.
Speaking of the post-Cold War era, your book is divided into two parts, Firemen and Badlands. What do these terms mean? And why do you divide history that way?
One of the ideas, and this again gets back to your earlier question about Kennedy, is what's so, about, you know, and Kennedy's influence. You know, the book starts with this speech by Kennedy, and it's in front of the American Friends for Vietnam. So it's this amazing bipartisan group. And we talk about, you know, Kennedy's influence on Vietnam, a bipartisan group that's opposed to the 1954 Geneva Accords, right? So basically does not want, the United States does not sign the Geneva Accords, the Geneva Accords, which divides Vietnam in half. But also there's supposed to be elections within 2 years in Vietnam that are never held. And so, you know, when Kennedy gives this speech at the American Friends for Vietnam, one of the things he's talking about, and it's a really interesting speech that I draw on it for a few reasons, is one, the commitment, as he talks about, to South Vietnam and what South Vietnam signifies to the United States. But he also kind of bemoans these American efforts as he sees them, you know, where America plays the world's fireman, as he calls it, right? That they're running out, they're putting out these mini fires and, you know, leaving behind kind of the bewildered masses. So these fires are these communist insurgencies, right? Which, for lack of a better term. But what's interesting about it, I think also, is that what Kennedy is not referencing, even though he references these countries, is how much at that point when he gives his speech, the United States is already actively, through Eisenhower's role in sponsoring coups in a number of different countries, is fomenting instability deliberately. And in fact, one of the things I talk about is a still classified report that we only have elements of, and it's referenced in a couple of different areas, the Bruce and Lovett report, right? So David Bruce and Robert Lovett, who criticized the CIA, and say that the CIA has gone away from its role of analysis, what they argue it was created for, and has instead become overwhelmingly on the operational side, and what they call, you know, effectively becoming kingmakers in the third world. And so what I'm trying to argue with the fireman piece is the following, is that instead of Kennedy's idea that these were in fact firemen putting out fires, that they start setting them, right, in part to contain this conflagration that's already underway in Vietnam, to contain the influence of Vietnam. And so we start to see the many different ways the United States gets involved in conflicts overseas, either because of real or perceived Soviet influence. And in many cases, it's because, you know, the U.S. doesn't want to deal with these domestic, you know, domestic issues that they're facing, these thorny problems, whether it's in Latin America, or as I talk about in the book, for example, when you get to Nixon with South Africa. You know, Nixon has a choice in South Africa, and he deliberately goes the other way. He deliberately breaks with Johnson's policy on isolating the white minority regimes in Southern Africa. And so there are a number of different avenues and options that the U.S. had that it chooses not to go after, right? It chooses not to pursue. And so instead of them actually being firemen by putting out these fires, they're actually starting them or helping them spread. So that's one idea. The Badlands idea is then what happens to those areas when the Cold War is over, and how much we see these intersections between America's domestic policy and those overseas areas. So this idea that these are, you know, the Badlands begins, you know, part of this is a notion that's taken from the American West that's applied to Prohibition era American cities and then exported overseas, as I talk about in the book, to South Asia, the Middle East, Latin America. So you see this, you know, these intersection points between the wars on crime, drugs, and terror over and over again, and the unwillingness to actually deal with kind of these really thorny issues, and instead to rely on a whether it's militarized domestic policy or militarized foreign policy.
Spencer Ackerman's book, Reign of Terror, makes a fundamentally similar argument to your Badlands section, but more specifically defines such Badlands internal American racial rhetoric as specifically part of Donald Trump and right-wing populism. I'm curious how you think such Badlands and sort of like us versus them rhetoric occurred before, during, and after the Trump administration. Like, is this a Trump phenomenon? How are we seeing it today with Biden?
Right. So I think one of the things that this book tries to make really clear is that this is not a Trump phenomenon, right? That this is, I start with Kennedy, but you could take it further back. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, back to your question about why Kennedy, you know, you could make the argument that, you know, some aspects of Vietnam policy were applied in Korea. The U.S. is drawing on several different examples. But what you don't get with kind of the failure of Korea is this existential angst in the U.S. And by the time you get to Donald Trump, and this is my argument in the book, you already have decades of U.S. policy that have failed, right? What Trump is, and this is in the, you know, I use it as an epigraph in the book, when Trump says, you know, we don't win anymore, right? He's tapping into this idea that America's best days are gone. Make America great again taps into that idea, but it's building on decades of successive issues and this idea of threats at home and threats abroad. You know, that's a very virulent aspect that he taps into. One of the things I talk about in the book is, for example, Michael Flynn arguing that he has sources in Border Patrol telling him that ISIS is sneaking in across the border with migrants and that there are way signs in Arabic pointing them where to go. This is a, but that doesn't come out of nowhere. Right. That base is there to that accepts this kind of message. And it's not because Trump invented it. It's because we have decades of a policy that's calling areas of major American cities badlands, that are calling areas overseas badlands. I mean, this is not something Trump invented. Trump inherited this. Right. So, you know, what I think is interesting, for example, you know, when I open this section on badlands is I talk about North Philadelphia. Right. And this area of North Philadelphia in the Kensington district, and how the neighborhood tried to challenge this notion. You know, they were shocked that the media and the police were calling them this. For years, we're trying to say, no, you know, we're good lands. This is, there are families here. We have homes, we have jobs, but we're being written off. And what's also interesting about that, and this takes us back to this focus on supply side, is the fact that as the newspaper accounts describe it, cars are coming off the major interstate into this area where there's open drug markets. They're buying the drugs and then getting back on the highway. They're not the residents of the town. So that's at one level. The other thing is when this rhetoric kicks in, you know, keep in mind, you know, these stories, they start. So, you know, what's so interesting about the George H.W. Bush presidency. And so, again, it's wrong to focus on Trump. George H.W. Bush will become president. And 9 months in, you know, and I talk about this, I trace this out in that chapter. One of the things he's going to run for president on is the fact it's his national security credentials. It's his amazing CV. And we talked a little bit about Reagan's mini war on terror. As vice president, Bush was the guy overseeing this mini war on terror, you know, according to investigative journalists, according to what we can piece together from what's been declassified so far. And that includes a report by Seymour Hersh and others. The other thing he's in charge of is, of course, the war on drugs. And so he is going to emphasize his role in one of the task force that oversees what, you know, the Caribbean operation. And what's great about the Caribbean operation is this, is that it's a great early example of kind of multi-agency task force with DOD. Okay, intercepting drugs in the Caribbean. And so I talk about how, you know, we have Senator John Kerry will lead a committee to examine the efficacy of the efforts, and then Senator Mitch McConnell, right? I mean, this is how long these guys have been in office, back to the 1980s, will say something like, you know, we've poured millions of dollars into this effort and it's not working. And so even though the Caribbean effort gets a lot of attention in the first year, that it's had a lot of interdiction and it's doing a great job, within 2 years, 3 years, everybody knows it's actually not effective. It keeps going. And instead, what we've also seen is transit routes have changed. So by the time, you know, Bush is running for president, his national security credentials, his credentials on the war on drugs, he is running on that. And so it's no accident that there's also polling that shows that, you know, actually, the U.S., the public is viewing negatively the Reagan administration's efforts on drugs, right? It's actually polling fairly high as a high priority issue going into the 88 election. Within 9 months, we have Bush launching this new war on drugs. And, you know, the famous speech from the Oval Office where he'll hold up a bag of crack that was bought. And it's this horrible story where they actually lure this 18-year-old kid. They have to tell him where the White House is. He doesn't know where the White House is. So they have to tell him where the White House is, lure him in, and then arrest him so that they can get this prop. And of course, very quickly, you know, the war on drugs, and you know, within a year or two, it's clear that, you know, this is a fully militarized war. And one of the key aspects is even more emphasis on DOD and its role in the Cold War arsenal. But then you get the intersection of the Persian Gulf War. War on drugs goes in the back burner. Everybody's focused on Desert Shield and then Desert Storm. And then, of course, I talk about that Badlands article. And where does that pop in? All of a sudden, that comes into the Philadelphia Inquirer. It's like about a month after the Gulf War is over. And now we're back to the war on drugs. What I'm trying to trace out there, and I'm hoping the readers will take away, is why is there this constant shift from a war in the Gulf to a war on drugs, from a war on drugs to a war in this, you know, to the LA riots, to we're constantly at war. It's a, and this constant threat and fear of safety at home that, of course, is then compounded by fear of safety abroad. So by the time Bush leaves, you know, there we have where the U.S. is getting involved in Somalia. And there's also this idea, in, including in media reports, about the need for a new security architecture, right? And that's linked to America's now even emboldened humanitarian efforts overseas. So this is, you know, the implications here are that American primacy, as it's going to be promoted, right, just the focusing on American primacy is, of course, linked to these varying security architectures that the U.S. is building overseas, whether it's for humanitarian purposes or for overt military action. And that's also linked back to the domestic angle, particularly dealing with social ills at home, where increasingly reliant on a militarized police force.
How does the Badlands narrative image work overseas?
So that's a great question. What's so fascinating about it is that it then starts getting applied after 9/11. You start seeing it pop up. Where does it get applied to? The cross-border areas between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And part of it is this thread. So, you know, where the idea of the Badlands gets coined during Prohibition era, effectively in Chicago, how it's defined is an area that's wild, savage. Well, that'll get taken. It'll get applied to the border area in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We'll hear things like, you know, it's been chaotic. Civilization hasn't come here, right? It is ruled by, you know, a tribal ethos. So all of these kind of notions of kind of a primitive level of civilization that now has to be tamed. And who's going to tame it? The United States will tame it. So this idea of the Badlands going from a urban area to now overseas, and then it just doesn't stay, for example, as I talk about in the book, it doesn't stay in South Asia. It then transports to, right, the Middle East. Gaza is described as a Badlands by 2008, and you know, Condoleezza Rice will add into it and call it, you know, Hamas has made Gaza a terrorist wasteland. So these links become important. And then, of course, it's what do you do there, right? When you have a Badlands, what kind of policies are needed? What is approved? Well, it turns out everything is approved, because how else do you deal with a terrorist wasteland or a stronghold or Badlands, right? So this idea that the myth of the American West gets applied not only to American urban areas, but then overseas as well. And we see that in the policies that are adopted, whether it is, as I talk about in the book, the drone war campaign. So the application of the drone war campaign, whether it's in Afghanistan or in Somalia or in Iraq or Yemen, where the U.S. is now saying, okay, any military age male, and keep in mind, what's a military age male? 16 to 35. Any military age male is a combatant. You know, in Gaza today, Israel is saying it's 14 and up are military age males. You know, when you look at that application of those kinds of rules, and this is why we start to see this sharp disparity between when the Pentagon was saying during the Bush and Obama years, well, you know, there was an airstrike and we killed this many combatants, and a smaller number of civilians were collateral damage. And then it turned out that that wasn't the case at all, that the number of civilian casualties were much higher. And what's even more disturbing about it is to come to find out that there were supposed to be that these drone strikes had people on the ground who were supposed to be providing information and to assist with the tracking. And so, you know, when you're seeing those kinds of policies, and I talk about that, the very real face of some of these policies in the book, it should give us pause, because we go from kind of the abstract, where we can think about how abstract that term is, Badlands, and what that implies, and what that implies about the people who live there. And then what that means for, because I think what's so fascinating about, for as we think about, and what I try and trace out in the book on Afghanistan, is that there were a number of options here for diplomatic resolution, in which the U.S. just continued, including as late as 2008. And I talk about Condoleezza Rice and the Bush administration misreading some of those deliberately, I would argue, right? And not applying, you know, another case where they could have applied some of the lessons from Iraq back to Afghanistan, and doing neither. And so when we look at, much like Vietnam, when we look at all the number of different attempts or policy options that were available, and that were avoided or ignored or delayed, we see that in Afghanistan as well.
I'm curious. I feel like I've seen this Badlands rhetoric getting kind of turned on its ear, particularly on the right and kind of at like the grassroots or engaged grassroots levels of politics, where people will use it as an argument for the United States to stay out of a place, you know, that we don't want to go into Mexico to, you know, like invade Mexico because it's this kind of place and we don't want to put our troops and our people in the middle of it, or Afghanistan. We don't want to stay there because it's this society with all these problems. We don't want to get in the middle of it. Or, you know, you'd hear the kind of ancient hatreds narratives about the Balkans or places like Iraq. And then my recollection is you would get kind of counterpoints to that back during like the Freedom Agenda era of the Bush administration, where it's like, well, hey, you guys have this like cynical and racist narrative of what's possible in Iraq. And actually, any place is capable of becoming a democracy, so we can go in and make it, you know, a high-functioning democracy at a low cost. And, you know, you guys who want to stay out are the ones with the bad attitudes, whereas we're the ones who have, you know, a positive, optimistic view of human nature and the universal desire for freedom. What do you make of that? Because I feel like I've seen this trend.
Right. What I think is so interesting is so the book, you know, I talk about kind of the lessons or the misapplied lessons of Vietnam. And I think you can also talk about the misapplied lessons of 9/11. Right. And we've seen that actually since October 7th again. Right. And so one of the questions is, you know, the argument I'm trying to make about the Badlands and this Badlands rhetoric is not for non-involvement. Right. It's also about the type of involvement you're having. Right. Are you entrenching these conflicts? Are you making them more difficult to resolve? So in almost every single case I discuss, I also talk about, for example, like Somalia, right, with the rise of the Shabab and a very deliberate U.S. policy that led to kind of further entrench that conflict, encouraging an invasion by Ethiopia, or Yemen, encouraging a Saudi intervention in Yemen. So one question is, what are the limits of military force? What is military force going to allow you to do? So when you think about back to the Freedom Agenda, directly tied to the Freedom Agenda was the idea that you were going to both liberate Iraq, quote unquote, from this dictator, and that you were going to impose freedom. And this is, it's a really similar kind of, when you look at kind of Rumsfeld's idea for what the U.S. was going to do, not just in Iraq, but in several other combat zones, was go in with a lightning fast force, overthrow the government, and then withdraw, and democracy would flourish, right? So it was almost this, the variation on Kennedy's fireman. What's interesting is that this in itself, and it's also a misapplying the lesson. Iraq was also a misapplying the lessons from World War II. You know, John, you will recall some of these discussions about, you know, the occupations of Japan and Germany, what the U.S. was able to do, and so how these historical lessons have been misapplied. One of the things I really want to get across in the book is there are limits to military force. It can't just be every time you see a nail, get your big hammer. I think that, you know, if we think about what's been going on since October 7th, I think, you know, quite frankly, and I'll come back to the Mexico example because I think it's a great one, again, about misapplying the lessons from the war on terror in Mexico. When the U.S. started airstrikes against Ansar Allah, the Houthi movement in Yemen, President Biden gives this, you know, impromptu comment to the press out in front of the White House where he says something to the effect of, are the airstrikes working? No. Will they continue? Yes. This fundamentally, you know, sums up U.S. foreign policy. If I had waited 3 months, if I'd known he was going to do that quote, I would have waited 3 months for the book just to put it as the epigraph up front, because it's kind of basically sums it up, you know, completely, right? One question is, what are the limitations of military force? Okay. One of the examples I give, and this is why I kind of rejected the focus on Trump, is Bill Clinton and Project Columbia in 1999. You have a very thorny negotiation that's coming up between the FARC and the Colombian government. Okay, FARC, the leftist rebels, who are now, you know, basically a major drug trafficking organization. The U.S. will, under Clinton in 1999, will deliberately launch Project Columbia to target the FARC, and part of the rationale is it's going to force the FARC to make concessions. This is exactly the Vietnam template. You know, adopted wholesale, because this is specifically what you heard in the launching of Operation Rolling Thunder, right? The bombing, the massive bombing in North Vietnam. Make the North beg for peace. These are exact quotes from the LBJ group. Make the North beg for peace. So when you start talking about, okay, we're gonna launch this effort, multi-billion-dollar effort in Colombia, and basically force the FARC to make concessions rather than trying to have a difficult negotiation. Okay. Keep in mind, how is that sold at home? The Clinton administration starts talking about we're going to remove cocaine from American streets within 3 years. It's a staggering claim. It's not the first time something like this has been made. Rockefeller made the same claim when they launched the Rockefeller drug laws in New York in the 1970s, that they were going to put drug dealers out of business, right? Part of it is what can military force achieve? Being honest with the American public about what it can achieve instead of with these outlandish goals. And then what is the reality on the ground that you are going into, right? So, you know, if you recall, since we talked about the Iraq example, one of the things that the Bush administration sold over and over again was that we're going to be greeted as liberators. We don't need a lot of troops, because they had to sell that it was going to be a small, right? Because Rumsfeld had his own idea about what a small military can do, but also they wanted to sell this that a small number was going to be needed, and that it'd be a quick occupation. It won't be an occupation at all. So that in and of itself encapsulates so many of kind of the fallacies of this argument. You talked about Mexico, and we talked about kind of misapplying the lessons of 9/11. You saw this among the Republican candidates when they start talking about, well, you know what, we're going to do drone strikes and special forces against the cartels. Then what you're going to do basically is then you're going to have, instead of having, I mean, this is one of the lessons of the war on drugs, right? So, and I trace this out. The Medellin cartel is targeted. Escobar is assassinated, right? The Cali cartel is targeted. They're imprisoned. And within a year, you have the New York Times saying, well, actually, you know, cocaine production hasn't been impacted at all, and actually may be more difficult to target the replacements because now there's 50 of them instead of two. Okay, so again, you know, there are red meat issues. So I think one of the things I'm hoping the book gets across, particularly to a younger group of readers, is how to avoid these kind of red meat answers for domestic politics. You know, how do you get away from the Republican candidates saying, oh, you know, and then try and outdo each other about, I'm going to do drone strikes against the cartels. I'm going to do special force. And I'm going to drop a nuke. You know, that's what we're waiting for. I'm just going to drop a nuke on Mexico and that'll take care of it. Because one of the things we have to start getting toward is the military is for certain purposes. The police are for certain purposes. You don't want the police doing social work, right? You want social workers doing social work. And the police will tell you, this is not what I can do, but I'm being forced to deal with, you know, issues of homelessness, issues of mental illness, domestic issues, and I'm not trained at that, right? The same thing when you're using your military to be your diplomats. One of the things I think that hasn't been made enough of after October 7th is the simple fact that Secretary of State Blinken was out at the Israeli War Cabinet. Why is America's chief diplomat sitting in on the Israeli War Cabinet? Secretary of State Blinken needs to be arguing and negotiating for a ceasefire, for a reduction in tensions. This is what you want the Secretary of State doing. He's not the first one. We saw the same thing under the Trump administration. I think there's a really telling anecdote I have in the book. We have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's arguing for an intervention in Iran. And who's holding him off is the Pentagon, who's saying this is the absolute wrong time for us to attack Iran. You know, the idea was that, you know, Iran is weakened by COVID. Now is the time for us to hit. I mean, why is the Secretary of State becoming your most vocal militant in the cabinet? And the Secretary of Defense is now put in the position where they're the ones arguing for ceasefires or for more specific targeting or for actually holding off and arguing for diplomacy. You know, one of the books I think that has not gotten enough attention the past few years is a book written by Robert Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, former CIA head, who talks about how much America's diplomatic corps has been weakened and the reliance on diplomatic tools has been weakened over the past decade to two decades and how much that needs to be rebuilt. I'm afraid we're going in the opposite direction. If you look at the lessons from Ukraine, the lessons from Gaza or from Yemen, it's going in the opposite direction, that those arguments are not being heard. And instead, what we're seeing is the Secretary of State, who now has to prove their toughness, right? That somehow they're the ones who have to be advocating for military force to give diplomacy some teeth. when they should actually be actually out negotiating. We saw this with Ukraine, where Secretary of State Blinken said, I'm not going to go negotiate. We won't negotiate till the fighting stops. How do you expect the fighting to stop? I mean, this is it's a remarkable turn in American diplomacy. John, to get back to your question, yes, of course, we're going to hear this kind of rhetoric where you'll hear the things like, oh, Sunni and Shia, they've been fighting each other for thousands of years. We shouldn't get involved. Well, that may or may not be true. Okay. The question is, how do you get involved? And what's the appropriate way to get involved if you're going to be involved, right? So the other, you know, and part of this comes back to, where does American prestige work, right? Why, if when you look at, for example, the Pew polls, where do we see America has a great amount of respect overseas and across the board? American universities, American popular culture, American innovation, right? Where does the United States constantly find itself? And that's why, you know, when I was trying to think of, like, is a world of enemies, you know, is this really the right title for the book? And the problem is that this is oftentimes how the rest of the world is viewed. And sometimes, as I argue in the book, how we view our own domestic issues, right? Who is and who is not a friend and who is not an enemy. This is, I think, one of the things we need to overcome.
There's so much more that we'd like to talk about, but that's all the time we have today. You can check out A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad from Kennedy to Biden, available wherever books are sold, meaning Amazon. And Dr. Khalil, thank you so much for coming on Security Dilemma.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
Security Dilemma is a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. To learn more about our programs, visit our website at jqas.org. Go to our JQAS Reading Groups page in the description of this episode to sign up for our reading group on Dr. Khalil's book. Apply to the JQAS Summer Conference by May 7th. Remember to rate and review in your podcast app and join us every Tuesday for new episodes of Security Dilemma.